However, the freed prisoners have already revealed that the Palestinian detainees suffered serious medical neglect during detention and now need medical attention.
The freed Palestinian prisoners and their families here in the occupied territories were filled with mixed emotions as 39 released women and minors found relief from the brutality of Israeli jails as part of a prisoner exchange agreement with Hamas. 39 is not just a number, as each of the freed Palestinians has a different story to tell after languishing for months in Israeli jails where thousands of Palestinian freedom fighters are still being held.
Inshallah, all the prisoners will be released. We have faith in Allah and the resistance. We didn't have a radio or television to know what was going on outside the prisons. We knew about the ceasefire and the deal when Israeli jailers raided our cells and started to bring out prisoners. They grabbed us by our clothes and dragged us away from the cells.
The moment we knew that the resistance had detained Israelis, I called my mom on that day. And she told me that resistance fighters had detained Israelis and that they were shelling the settlements. All female inmates started to scream for joy. Then the soldiers broke into our cells and attacked and beat us. And since then, the majority of us have been held in solitary confinement and all of our belongings had been seized. We do not have enough food or water. And we were literally being mistreated. When we were informed that there was a swap deal, we were happy but sad at the same time because of the martyrs in Gaza. We are proud of Gaza and the resistance, and may God bless the martyrs.
13 Israeli captives were released by Hamas as part of the swap deal. Israel has agreed to release 150 Palestinian women and children prisoners in exchange for Hamas releasing 50 of the women and children taken captive during the Al-Aqsa flood operation on the 7th of October. The prisoner exchange takes place during the four-day truce in the Gaza Strip, and that's why this relief is mixed with sadness as Palestinians fear the resumption of Israeli hostilities in Gaza after the ceasefire expires. The swap deal, however, is not the end of the story, as families of other prisoners hope all their loved ones will be freed soon.
What Hamas did, she make it this time with force. Even we lost a lot of blood. My people, I passed away. They killed hospitals, they killed people, they killed everywhere. But we still believe that this is our right and we'll take our freedom, whatever will happen. We will give this and we will give more years. Kamal Nail for him is 44 years in prison. His age now is 66. And we have Kamal Suher Burkhouti, she's in prison too, which is her 64. We believe this is the first step. And inshallah, we hope with the people, with their strongest, which they are, we will have the next step, which is liberate of all Palestine.
Before October 7, there were about 5,200 Palestinians in Israeli jails. However, in the last few weeks, the number of Palestinian inmates skyrocketed as another 3,000 were detained. The release of those Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails gives a glimmer of hope for thousands of detainees and their families that the resistance will keep its promise to release all prisoners. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Asil Munir was a Palestinian prisoner from the city of Nablus. She was released from an Israeli jail on Friday as part of a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. She speaks about her plans for her future.
Being with my family fills me with happiness, but this happiness is tainted with sorrow because our release from prison came at the cost of the lives of martyrs and innocent children. I have a strong desire to continue my education at university. I want to travel and become a surgeon solely to help and alleviate the suffering and pain of the Palestinian people as much as I can. It is my aspiration to provide them with the same healing and relief that they provided us while we were in Israeli prisons.
In the Gaza Strip, more than 24 hours have passed since a temporary ceasefire took effect between Israel and the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, but there are signs of Israel's violation of the truce. A loud blast was heard near the border between Gaza and the southern occupied Palestinian territories. Following the blast, a cloud of black smoke was seen rising over the besieged Strip. According to reports, Israeli forces also heavily fired at the city of Huza in the eastern Khan Yunis region. The four-day Gaza truce came into effect on Friday at 7 a.m. local time. As part of the truce, Israel freed 39 Palestinian prisoners held in its jail. In return, Hamas released 13 captives held since Palestinians' Al-Aqsa flood operation on October the 7th. The truce led to a pause in the Israeli bombing of Gaza. Over 14,800 Palestinians have been killed in the war on Gaza. Gaza residents are pleased to see the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas making gains in the war with the Israeli regime. They are also grateful to Hamas for forcing Tel Aviv into agreeing to a truce.
Here, honestly, feel a sense of triumph, feel a sense of victory, seeing the first images and videos of the beginning of all of the Palestinian women and children being released from Israeli occupier jails, honestly, brings great pride to the Palestinians here.
On the 7th of October, the Palestinian resistance achieved great victory, and we are fully backing Hamas. We thank the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas for forcing the Israeli regime to accept the humanitarian ceasefire, and we always wish Hamas more victories and triumphs.
The resistance broke the back of Israel and defeated it by humiliating Israeli soldiers on October the 7th in the border areas east of Gaza. Israel was forced to negotiate indirectly with the Hamas resistance, although Israel started this war to destroy Hamas. Hamas forced Israel to accept the truce on Hamas's terms.
I pray to Almighty Allah to protect the resistance and protect Hamas fighters who bravely fought Israel in order to protect us. We needed this truce, and Hamas forced Israel to accept the four-day truce. We lost our loved ones and our homes because of the silence of the international community.
The resistance has been fighting the Zionist enemy with the will of Almighty God. Hamas fighters are God's warriors fighting the terrorist infidel enemy. They defeated the Zionist enemy on the first day of this war, and they defeated it again by forcing Israel to accept the truce.
Palestinians have held a funeral for Shameh Kamal, a medical doctor shot dead by Israeli forces during their latest raid into the occupied West Bank. The 25-year-old was killed in a village near the city of Jenin. Two other Palestinians, including Kamal's brother, were injured as well. Israeli forces carried raids into several other towns and villages, including the Askar refugee camp east of Nablus and the Akbat Jab refugee camp south of Ariha. In response, Palestinian resistance fighters managed to shoot down an Israeli drone flying over Kabatia near Jenin. Since the onset of the Gaza war, the Israeli forces have killed more than 200 Palestinians and detained hundreds more in the occupied West Bank. Rallies have been held across the globe in solidarity with Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Thousands of protesters joined a pro-Palestinian march in London, demanding an end to the genocide in Gaza. They voiced their support for Palestinians and called for a permanent ceasefire in the besieged territory. Demonstrators lamented that the UK government is not hearing the voice of the nation, which was once an end to Israeli attacks on Gaza and also the settlement of the long-running conflict in Palestine. A similar rally was also held in Odense in Denmark, with protesters calling on the UN to stop the Israeli genocide in Gaza and to hold the regime accountable for its crimes. In Sri Lanka's capital, Colombo, protesters gathered in front of the U.S. embassy to express their solidarity with Palestinians. They condemned the U.S. support and arms delivery to Israel during the ongoing war. Some protesters held signs featuring the images of U.S. President Joe Biden and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, labeling them as murderers and criminals. Mona Kandil joins us from Occupied Ramallah, a correspondent there, and Fra Hughes is a journalist, author, and activist joining us from Belfast. Welcome to you both. Mona, tell us about the delay. Apparently, there's a delay that has happened, the reasons for it, and when will it be resumed, if that info is available?
Yes. Hamas brigades issued a statement saying that the second stage of the prisoner swap deal and releasing the second group of Israeli hostages will be postponed till when it's not clear. They are saying that Israel had failed to comply with the ceasefire agreement. This, what the Hamas movement is saying, is that the Israelis did not respect the list that has been agreed upon, where the Israelis were supposed to release Palestinian prisoners, women and children, who had with long sentences and who had been who had spent years behind bars. They changed the whole list. They did not respect the criteria of the swap deal. And at the same time, Hamas is saying that there had been an agreement by the Israelis to allow the humanitarian aid to northern the Gaza Strip. And there were statements for Osama Hamdan from Lebanon, this senior Hamas leader, is saying that the Israelis also did not respect the ceasefire when people were trying, people in the Gaza Strip who had moved to southern the Gaza Strip, they were trying to return back to northern the Gaza Strip and to the center of the city in order to check their relatives and family members and also their homes. And the Israeli forces had opened fire at the people even before they reached a close area to southern, to the center or the middle of the Gaza Strip or the northern areas, when they were close to Gaza Valley or Wadi Gaza, as it's said in Arabic. The Israeli forces opened fire at the Palestinians, and two people had been shot and killed. Others had been wounded. Now, the Israeli military is saying that if the second group of the hostages are not freed by midnight, then the Israeli military will be resuming the ground operation in the Gaza Strip, and they are threatening that Hamas movement knows exactly the steps or the issues that had been agreed according to the swap deal and the ceasefire agreement. The Israelis in more than an hour from now claimed that the Red Cross had received the 13 Israeli prisoners. However, immediately later, the Israelis or the Hamas movement said that they did not hand over the Israeli prisoners to the Red Cross, and they revealed about its intention to postpone the release. And we are receiving now that the Israeli troops had raided Jenin, and they are surrounding two hospitals, Jenin governmental hospital as well as Ibn Sina hospital, and the clashes are taking place there. And at the same time, when Palestinian family members of those prisoners went to the jail of Ofer, or the area close to the jail of Ofer and the military checkpoint of Bitunia, like what happened yesterday, the Israeli forces opened fire at the people to disperse them, and at least four Palestinians had been wounded, while the Israeli military had stated from the very beginning that celebrations are not allowed. People gathering outside the Ofer jail or an area close to it is also not allowed, where Palestinians are prevented to celebrate. But at the end of the day, the people themselves, they say that they cannot celebrate at the time their sons and daughters are being released. But on the other hand, the children, women, elderly are being killed in the Gaza Strip, and Israel has been launching a massacre and a genocide against the people there.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Mona Kandil from Occupied Ramallah. Fra Hughes joins us now from Belfast, journalist, author, and activist. So, Fra Hughes, we're looking at the unfortunate delay that's taking place because Israel decides not to honor the commitments that it had made under the truce. Tell us what your thoughts are on that, and where do you think that this may go? Of course, many deals in the past have had bumps, but this is one that is very sensitive, to say the least.
I think it's very important, and I think it's a sign of strength that Hamas have said that they are holding Israel to account. They're holding them to their word. And there's no point having people like the negotiators from Egypt and Qatar coming together, organizing, spending time, energy, and weeks to bring about a truce stroke pause in the conflict in order to allow an exchange of hostages and on both sides, really, because the people being released from Ofer prison are many of whom have not been brought through judicial procedure, never been charged with a crime, just kept in jail and being refused to be released. So on one level, it shows the strength of Hamas, that they are not just accepting whatever the Israelis choose to do. I think when I first heard the news, which was actually from your correspondent there, it struck me that this was going to put huge pressure on Netanyahu. The fact that they had 13 people released and returned to Israel yesterday, a joy for their families and for Israeli society at large. But for that to then stop because of duplicity and lies and back dealings by the Israeli government and the Israeli army and the Israeli prison service, this is going to put huge pressure on Netanyahu, even if he returns to carpet bombing Gaza tonight at 12 a.m., the people within Israel who were expecting to have their loved ones returned, I imagine are going to be very, very, very angry. And the Palestinians who now won't see their loved ones released in the short term, I think we were going to maybe witness a hiatus. I think if the prisoners aren't released by Hamas, there will be a return to the bombings. And sadly, with the loss of life in Gaza, that will entail. But I think over the next 2 or 3 days, they will return to the process of exchanging captives and nationals on each side, because ultimately I believe Netanyahu only accepted to sit down and negotiate with Hamas because of the pressure he was feeling from the relatives who marched from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, whom he met last week. And I think he promised them that he would get the prisoners out. So there'd be more pressure on him, and I see it. I see them coming together again, possibly in a day or two, for like take two on the truce stroke humanitarian pause.
Okay, thank you very much for that. And that is it for World News. Bye bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The White House needs a cover story to obscure its complicity. In desperation, it is once again resurrecting the long-dead two-state solution. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, "The White House faces a dilemma. It has the power to stop the death and destruction in Gaza in its tracks at any time of its choosing, but it chooses not to. The U.S. is determined to back its client state to the hilt. giving the Zionist regime license to wreck the tiny coastal enclave, seemingly whatever the cost in Palestinian lives. But the optics, and that is all that concerns Washington, are disastrous. TV images have shown hundreds of thousands of Palestinians fleeing their destroyed homes on a scale unseen since the Zionist regime's earlier mass ethnic cleansing operations of 1948 and 1967. Even the Western media is struggling to obscure the veritable mountain of crushed and bleeding bodies in Gaza. The known death toll has now surpassed 13,000, with thousands more buried under rubble. Those who survive face a genocidal policy, starving them of food, water, and power. Western publics are growing increasingly incensed. Protest marches have attracted numbers not seen since the mass demonstrations against the Iraq War 20 years ago. In private, U.S. allies in the West Asia region are pleading with the U.S. to use its leverage to restrain the Zionist regime. Meanwhile, Washington is only too aware of how quickly Israel's regional opponents could get dragged in, dangerously expanding and escalating the conflict. But what the Biden administration really needs is a cover story to justify the fact that it is continuing to supply the weapons and funding needed by the Zionist regime to carry out its crimes in broad daylight. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken set out his stall at the G7 summit recently. The goal is to shift the focus away from Zionist regime's genocidal policies in Gaza and Washington's backing for them, to a purely theoretical discussion about what might happen after the fighting ends. Outlining his post-war vision for Gaza, Blinken said, "It's also clear that Israel cannot occupy Gaza. Now the reality is that there may be a need for some transition period at the end of the conflict. We don't see a reoccupation, and what I have heard from Israeli leaders is that they have no intent to reoccupy Gaza." James Cleverly, Britain's former foreign secretary, echoed his U.S. counterpart, insisting power would in Gaza be handed to a peace-loving Palestinian leadership. Both appear to favor the Palestinian authorities, Mahmoud Abbas taking over Gaza or what's left of it. This bad faith maneuver is off the charts, even by the pair's usual mendacious standards. Both the U.S. and Britain want them to believe that, at least while Palestinians are being massacred day after day, that they are serious about reviving the long-cold cadaver of the two-state solution. The layers of deceit are so plentiful, they need to be peeled away one by one. The first glaring deception is Washington's insistence that the Zionist regime avoid reoccupying Gaza. Blinken wants us to believe that the Strip's occupation ended long ago, when the Zionist regime dismantled its Jewish colonies in 2005 and pulled out the troops who protected the settlers. But if Gaza was not actually occupied before the Zionist regime's current ground invasion, how does Washington explain the Israeli regime's blockade of the tiny enclave for the past 16 years? How did Israel manage to seal off Gaza's land borders, block access to Gaza's territorial waters, and patrol Gaza's skies 24/7? The reality is that Gaza has not experienced a day free of Israeli occupation since 1967. All that the Zionist regime did 18 years ago when it pulled out its Jewish settlers was to run the occupation more remotely. exploiting new developments in weapons and surveillance technologies. The Zionist regime developed and refined a very sophisticated arm's-length occupation using Israeli teenagers with joysticks at distant sites to play God with the lives of 2.3 million imprisoned Palestinians. The Zionist regime is not in danger of reoccupying Gaza. It never stopped occupying it. Another deceit is the impression Blinken is intentionally creating that the U.S. is preparing for a confrontation with the Zionist regime over Gaza's future. The Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made clear he is in no mood to sit down with Palestinian leaders, even of the peace-loving kind. Recently, he once again declared that Israel would take security control of the enclave as soon as Hamas was gone. He told Israelis recently, "There will be no Hamas. There will be no civilian authority that educates their children to hate Israel, to kill Israelis, to destroy the state of Israel." He claimed that Israeli troops would be able to go into Gaza whenever they want in order to kill terrorists, as he claimed. Certainly, the Zionist regime's military commanders seem to be taking this message to heart, vowing that they are back in Gaza for good. But the suggestion that the Zionist regime and Washington are not on the same page is pure trickery. The row is entirely confected, designed to make it look like the Biden administration, in pushing for negotiations, is taking the Palestinian side against the Zionist regime. Nothing could be further from the truth. The presence is a boon to both sides. The U.S. wants to look like one day, after all Gaza's homes are destroyed and its people ethnically cleansed, it will drag Netanyahu to the negotiating table, kicking and screaming. An embattled Netanyahu, meanwhile, is able to score popularity points with the Israeli right by posturing defiantly against the Biden administration. It is pure theater. The confrontation will never materialize. The U.S. vision is nothing more than make-believe.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Sheikh Salim Bimji.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Tonight the topic is more of how, when we put everything together, and what we want to look at is the concept of a functional family. The one thing that we have to begin with is how Allah says, وَأَنْكِهُ الْأَيَامَ. And Mary, speaking to the single men and women of our communities, one of the things that we understand is that in Islam, marriage is a choice. Once this choice is made, you know, when we come back to this verse, and the word Allah uses, وَأَنْكِهُ, and Mary, Ayatollah Nasser Makarem Shirazi, in his tafsir of this verse, he gives us three ways that this one word can be understood, or three aspects of marriage that can be extrapolated from this one word of the verse. Number one is, he says that this word tells us that we as a community, as parents, as caregivers, we need to encourage our children towards marriage. Right? We need to encourage them, not only in words, you know, telling them to get married or encouraging them, but in our actions. Again, I've seen personally families where the father is so abusive to his wife, maybe not physically, but mentally and through words, which is equally as haram and problematic, and problematic even from the secular system. He has been so vicious with his wife in front of the children that the children no longer want to get married. They've lost all desire because they see, my dad is abusing my mom in this way. Is this how men treat women in marriage? Right? And by children seeing that very toxic relationship between husband and wife, this will put them off from marriage. Now, again, husbands and, you know, a man and a woman will have differences, but as all the experts say, that they need to deal with those in privacy, behind closed doors, not in front of the children, that they yell and scream. And, you know, even as we have seen and heard, you know, the wife and the husband getting into physical altercations with one another. This is a reality. Not only husbands physically abusing the wives, but the wife many times physically abusing their husband. And when children see this, they get into this thought that I'm not going to get married. Why should I put myself in a position that just as my mom is? Or why should I be in a position just like my dad is being abused? So Ayatollah Makarem says, yes, we have to encourage our children to marriage, but it's not just through verbal words, right? Or lectures and majalis and lectures and seminars and conferences about marriage. It's about living the ideal marriage. And we have to study the life of, for example, Rasulullah and Ummul Mu'mineen Khadija alayha salam and sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. How did they live in matrimony and happiness in times of ease and times of difficulty? Right? When the Prophet and the end of the life of Khadija alayha salam, when she had nothing, when all her wealth had been expended in the way of Islam, the Prophet was no different to her in his love. He still loved her even though she had nothing left in terms of material to give. You look at the Prophet even when he moves to Medina and he marries many other women. You look at how his relationship was with wives like Aisha and Hafsa. It's no secret if you read the Quran Surah Tahrim chapter 66 that when Aisha and Hafsa, although not mentioned by name in the verse, but there are clear hadith from all Muslims that these initial ayat refer to them. When they would accuse the Prophet of having a very bad smelling mouth, that he smelled bad. When they would pass secrets back and forth to one another, and the Prophet would tell them, I'm telling you a secret, don't tell it to anybody, and she would go and divulge it. Allah is very clear, reprimanding Aisha and Hafsa. There's nothing to be ashamed about when we read these ayat and ask or review the tafsir that these two wives of the Prophet were guilty of insulting the Messenger and of planning and plotting against him, as the Quran clearly says. But what does Allah say to the Prophet even in those times? He says that if Allah wants, He could divorce those two and get you much better, pious, loving, caring. He gives so many beautiful attributes, saying that these two were not like that. He didn't physically hit them or attack them or, you know, do anything. He let Allah deal with that situation, but he dealt with it as the Prophet of Allah. He didn't raise his voice. He didn't hit them. He didn't curse at them. No, he dealt with them in a respectable manner. So that is one thing. Another thing that Ayatollah Makarem mentions is that we need to create a responsible and safe way for our boys and girls to meet, to get married with one another in our communities. Again, we see this around us that our children are going to public school. They're going to university. They're mixing with people of other religions. And I could probably count many people, maybe 5 or 10 that I know from our community who have married outside of Islam. Forget about marrying outside of Ahlul Bayt's teachings, that they've married people who are not even Muslims. Right? So this is a major concern. And we have to find a way. of how do we ensure that our children can interact with one another in an Islamic environment, that they get to meet one another in a permissible way, and that they can form their or find their partner from within our religious community, rather than going out and looking for their partner. And number three, Ayatollah Makarim says, from this one word, wa'ankihu, and marry, he says we need as a community to provide the financial means for our youth to get married. You know, again, it's a major issue in some communities. All communities do marriage differently. Some youth that I have even seen are very comfortable with a very simple marriage. They come to the masjid, you know, the family is there, community members are there. A few thousand dollars is spent to feed the community and the marriage is over in half an hour. And then I've been to weddings that last 3-4 days in our community. Wednesday there's one program, Thursday there's another program, Friday there's another event, Saturday finally is the nikah and the dinner, and Sunday maybe is the walima for the other side of the family. Right? I've seen weddings where people have sent me invitations for the wedding, a wedding invitation written on a scroll in a glass bottle filled with sand, couriered to every single household. Right? Maybe $100 per invitation or more they've spent. So I've seen two extremes. And I've also seen some of these same weddings last 10 days. And the man and the woman have separated. They're divorced after 2 weeks at marriage. And then I've seen marriages for 30 years. They only met one another through a photo. They didn't even have, you know, FaceTime to talk with. And they've been married for 30 years now. Right? So the point being is that as a community, we have to recognize these are issues. We have to support our youth. I see like India, I see Pakistan, I see Iran, I see Iraq facilitating marriage for their youth, paying, you know, arranging the marriage ceremony, the basics of the house, the fridge, a stove, dishes, basic things. And I say, if they can do that over there, why can't we have a fund for our youth that need to tap into it? Not all youth will need that support. But if our youth need it today, do they have an organization they can go to get not only these things, but even if they need a loan, if they need to borrow money for a marriage, where do our youth go to get these things if they can't afford? Right? Do we expect them to live a life of haram, as we talked about a few nights ago, or do we want to provide them that level of support that they need?
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareemun Azim Alimul Halim Hakimun Mateen شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
In Britain, a new study has revealed the harsh impact of benefit cuts and cost of living crisis, with 1 million British children experiencing destitution last year. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. More than 1 million children experienced destitution last year, meaning their families could not afford to adequately feed, clothe or clean them, or keep them warm, according to a major study which reveals an explosion of extreme poverty in the United Kingdom. Severe material hardship was no longer a rare occurrence, the study found, with rates of destitution more than doubling in the last 5 years as a result of benefit cuts and cost of living pressures, leaving struggling households increasingly reliant on regular charity handouts. Poverty campaigners, teachers and frontline welfare workers have expressed growing alarm about the damaging effect of destitution, particularly on children, including physical ill health, undernourishment, mental illness, social isolation, school absences and poor classroom behaviour. An estimated 1.8 million British households, containing nearly 3.8 million people, including 1 million children, were destitute at some point in 2022, according to the new study published by the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. Half of the destitute households tried to get by on less than £85 a week after housing costs, with a quarter reporting no income at all. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation's chief executive, Paul Kissack, criticised the government for in effect ignoring the rise in destitution in Britain. "The government is not helpless to act, it is choosing not to act," he said. "Turning the tide on destitution is an urgent moral mission which speaks to our basic humanity as a country, and we need political leadership for that mission." A co-author of the study, Professor Suzanne Fitzpatrick of Heriot Watt University in Edinburgh, described soaring destitution as morally reprehensible and said the UK state had abdicated its responsibility to society's poorest. "There must be immediate action from all levels of government to tackle this social emergency," Professor Fitzpatrick said. "Destitution is defined as the inability to meet basic physical needs, to stay warm, dry, clean and fed, either because of lack of clothing, lack of heating, shelter or food, or because household income falls below a minimum level after housing costs, ranging from £95 a week for a single adult to £205 a week for a couple with two children." The study, the latest in a series tracking the phenomena since 2015, also interviewed people about their experiences of destitution. The study found adults reported a frequent inability to afford more than one meal a day, often going without to ensure their children could eat. Nearly two-thirds, or 61%, said they had gone hungry in the past month. There was heavy reliance on food banks and relatives for groceries. More than half of destitute adults, or 51%, regularly went without toiletries such as shampoo and toothpaste, as well as hygiene and cleaning products, often relying on food banks for these items. One respondent had to borrow money to buy essentials for her disabled daughter. New clothing and footwear were essential items that people simply did not buy at all, the study concluded, with many adult respondents wearing worn-out clothes and only buying new clothes such as school uniforms and trainers for their children. Destitution, once largely limited to immigrants ineligible for social security support, was now predominantly experienced by British nationals in receipt of welfare benefits, and increasingly by families, the study revealed, One in 10 destitute households included working adults. Disabled people and people with long-term chronic health conditions and Black, British, Caribbean and African households were disproportionately likely to be destitute. The number of destitute lone parents almost tripled between 2019 and 2022, while the number of children experiencing destitution has tripled since 2017. The erosion of state support for people in severe hardship and their growing reliance on informal help from charities and parents was one of the most striking aspects of the new research. More than 574,000 destitute people were supported by food banks in 2022, up from 214,000 in 2019. The study noted the critical role of volunteer food banks in the lives of the poorest households, despite concern over their ability to meet rising demand. One charity worker told researchers, "We used to worry about food banks opening. Now we're worrying about food banks closing. That's how bad it is in our country right now." Meager benefit rates meant a single adult on the basic £85 weekly rate of universal credit was by definition in severe hardship, falling below the £95 a week destitution threshold, the study found. The two-child benefit limit and benefit sanctions also drove destitution. The UK's social security system was full of holes, it concluded. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation called on all political parties to commit to a plan to eradicate destitution in Britain, including an overhaul of benefit rates to provide an essential guarantee which would ensure universal credit was sufficient to protect households from severe hardship. A government spokesperson said, "Our number one priority is driving down inflation because that will help everyone's money go further." There are 1.7 million fewer people in absolute poverty than in 2010, including 400,000 fewer children. But we know some families are currently struggling, which is why we are providing support worth an average of £3,300 a household, including raising benefits by over 10% this year, and are increasing the national living wage also. Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. More than 1 million British children experienced the most extreme form of poverty last year, according to a new report that slams such horrifying levels of destitution as a political choice. According to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, the number of people experiencing these levels of poverty in the United Kingdom has increased by 61% between 2019 and 2022, with 3.8 million people experiencing destitution in Britain. Over half of destitute households have a weekly income of less than £85. Children are particularly hard hit. The numbers experiencing destitution has almost tripled, an increase of 186% since 2017. People are considered destitute if they have not been able to meet their most basic physical needs to stay warm, dry, clean and fed. This can be because they either lack necessities like clothing, heating, shelter or food, or because their income is so extremely low that they're unable to purchase these items for themselves. The report, the fourth in a series of destitution in the United Kingdom studies published regularly in recent years, puts the rise down to a combination of very low income, rising cost of living, and high levels of debt. But it also blamed the social security system for failing to protect people, with 72% of those destitute being in receipt of universal benefits. Paul Kissack, the chief executive of the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, accused the British government of failing to act. Paul Kissack said, "Such severe hardship should have no place in the United Kingdom today, but the British public will not stand for destitution on this scale. The government is not helpless to act, it is choosing not to act. Turning the tide on destitution is an urgent moral mission, which speaks to our basic humanity as a country, and we need political leadership for that mission. That is why we are calling for clear proposals from all political parties to address this challenge with the urgency that it demands. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the organizers of the International Congress in honor of Allama Sayyid Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai on November 8, 2023. The late Allama Tabatabai was one of the exceptional wonders of our seminaries in the last centuries. The qualities that made up this man's character were all some of the superior virtues of a person. A combination of qualities such as knowledge, piety, morality, literary talent and artistry, and sincerity and friendship were what formed the personality of this great man. One point regarding the knowledge of this noble man was the wide scope of his knowledge. He was an expert in the principles of jurisprudence. He was a philosopher, and he had a deep understanding of theoretical mysticism. He was a scholar in astronomy and mathematics. He was an outstanding scholar in the interpretation of the Quran and the Quranic sciences. He was truly unparalleled in this field. He was a skilled poet.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
He was skilled and active in the science of genealogy. My late father was friends with Mr. Tabatabai from the time they were in Najaf. My father himself told me this. My father wrote a letter to Mr. Tabatabai asking him to ask a certain person, a famous man in Qom, for our family tree, and then he wanted it sent to him. Now, I don't remember his exact words, but in response to this letter, Mr. Tabatabai wrote, "I know genealogy as much as he does or more." So he prepared our family tree and sent it. In other words, the family tree that is currently in our hands was prepared by Mr. Tabatabai. In the field of mathematics, he drew the layout for the Hujjatiya Seminary, a prominent seminary in Qom. He was a magnificent, proficient architect. Mr. Tabatabai's scientific diversity was one of the special dimensions of his scientific knowledge. Another dimension was the depth of his scientific and intellectual knowledge. In the science of principles, he was a master of tenets. In philosophy, he was an innovative philosopher. He presented a philosophical system which may be seen in his book, The Principles of Philosophy and the Method of Realism, as well as in two other of his books that he wrote not long ago, the books Bidaya and Nihaya. In the science of commentary on the Quran, he was an extraordinary exeget.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty. and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon his word, and I cling only to his cord. In thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from